Good Monday evening, Chicago. Good Monday evening, America.
This is Kelly Pope and...
And Professor Fraud, Bill Cressy, all the way from Governor State University.
And this is True Crime with us. Bill, how you been?
Busy?
Yeah, were traveling last week,
no,
right?
This weekend I was traveling. I flew down to beautiful Austin, Texas.
Keep Austin weird, right?
That's what they say. Keep Austin weird. And I did a couple of things down there. Met with folks at the headquarters of the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners, which is based in Austin. And met with the... Vice President of Education down there, and had a nice meeting with that. And then there was a meeting going on at in Austin of the National Association of Faculty Senates.
Wow, that sounds like so interesting. Like what I would want to do in Austin all day.
Yeah. It's a new, brand new organization, and we were. I am the parliamentarian for the Faculty Senate at Governor State
You're
University.
Really,
and so, well, we were going over the constitution and bylaws of this new organization.
Okay, what good restaurants did you go to while you're in Austin?
the hotel restaurant was very nice.
Okay.
And they had free breakfast. So I pretty much just ate there.
Yeah. That's good. Let's see.
And where you been traveling? A lot.
Every week is something. But I'm getting a lot of my energy tonight from class. So my Mondays are pretty long because I teach three classes on Monday and then come here.
What time do you start?
I have a 10:10, have a 1:30, get out at 3, then teach from 6 to 9 and rush over here. So it's a long day.
Wow.
But I talk crime for 3 hours and 15 minutes with my forensic accounting class. Ooh. And then I head over here. So typically this raspy radio voice you hear... is because I've been talking all day long.
Oh, okay. It's not like you're, been drinking whiskey and smoking cigarettes all day.
No.
So what kind of crimes were you talking about today?
Well, tonight we were playing this new investigative experience that I created with this incredible creative marketing guru. Her name's Ronnie Jackson. It's called Red Flag Mania. Ooh. So we're playing this for the next 4 weeks. You're gonna come by and check it out. You would love it.
Okay, by red flags, these are like construction crews trying to keep you off the road?
Not quite. Red flags are exactly what you think. So red flags are things that alert you to fraud that you often overlook, and we overlook them, but we don't miss them. We see them, but we just don't respond to them. So sort of like the things that we talk about in our dupe of the week hour.
Sure. As I say to a lot of people about fraud, after they realize they've been defrauded, there's what I call the surprise party effect. Because if you've ever had a surprise party pulled on you, you're like, oh, surprise. Oh, I didn't see this coming. And then like 15 minutes later,
you start thinking back to all the things.
I saw somebody walking in with a sheet cake, half an hour ago. And somebody bringing in balloons. Of course they were going to celebrate my birthday. Yeah. And that's the same thing with fraud. They're like, at first, amazed that this was going on. And then they think back and it's like, oh, my goodness, all the red flags were there.
Yep. All the red flags were there. So this game is it's all these different parts. Like first you have to identify who done it. So it's like this race to discover to solve this case. And so the students are just so into it. They love it. So they watch a film and they're launched into this situation. Then they have an investigative box. They have all this evidence that they have to go through and solve and figure out who did it. And then there's a piece where you have to go through the all the internal identify all the internal control weaknesses in the organization. Then you go and identify all the
internal controls being like things that management or policies a company would have so you don't get caught up in the
absolutely.
Fraud.
Okay. Absolutely. So an internal control that we deal with every day is checking at a security desk, giving them your ID and making sure that you are who you say you are.
Yeah.
You have access to go up into the building. That's an internal control.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're not on the list and they have to call and say, hey, are you going to let this guy named Bill Cressy come upstairs?
And they usually say no.
They say no. that's another step in the internal control process. So they're all around us.
Yeah.
They're all around us.
And so much so that's most people don't even realize it's like, you know, well, the boss says I have to do this.
Right.
I have to, after we pay a bill, I have to stamp it paid.
Right.
Which seems like a kind of silly process, but I know of some folks here in Chicago who lost like $1.25 million
yep.
because they weren't stamping their bills paid.
Right. Or something as simple as when you go out, and I know at my school, when you go out, you have to list everybody that was at the dinner before you can get reimbursed to make sure you're going out with colleagues and not your family. You know, so there's lots of internal controls that are all around us, and they're all to protect us.
So as part of this game, they have to identify the weaknesses in the internal control.
Yeah, and but you have to go through all the evidence to figure it out. So you have to read, like, the policies and say, okay, what was on paper versus what did they actually do?
Right.
So so it's a lot of fun. So it lasts an entire month.
Wow.
So
so they figure out who done it.
Figure out
how they done it. Is that
I like your slang.
Apparently I'm not an English major. My wife is probably listening. She was a copy editor for a major newspaper.
She's like, what is he just saying?
And do they then have to figure out how much was stolen?
Yeah, how they did it.
Okay.
And then there's a whole data analytics piece. So they have to do a data dive. So they have all a million data points that they have to use the data to try to solve the crime. So it's just a very immersive experience. And so, since you know I love making films,
yes.
Because I made what? All the Queen's Horses,
which will be on WTTW
starting November 7th.
So, being WTTW, they show it a whole bunch of times.
Yeah, but you know what?
What?
You're going to have to interview me. I'll have to be the guest.
Okay. Okay, well, have you get but then, you know, I don't think you get paid that weekend, you know? We'll give you the free the free Papa Nicholas coffee. Yeah, it's good stuff, Papa Nicholas coffee.
So there's a film component, an investigative piece, and then a reveal. So I can't tell you what the reveal is until you come to class.
Well, if it's like Law and Order, it's someone different in the last 2 minutes of the whole thing, right?
Right. So that's what I did today.
Wow.
Head into Vegas tomorrow night. So I'm glad I had time to be here tonight.
Wow, where are you staying in Vegas?
MGM.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So I'm going to a conference.
And, of course, when you check in, you use the Vegas sandwich, right?
Huh?
Ooh, the Vegas sandwich. Well, tell you what.
What's the
Do we have a break coming up now? Why don't we go to a break? And during the break, I'll tell you about the Vegas sandwich. And then afterward,
I need to know what the Vegas sandwich. Okay,
I will tell you.
Okay.
But afterward, we have a guest joining us on the phone, Diane Capone, the granddaughter of Al Capone.
All right.
Okay. So let's go to a break right now. Yeah, and we're back. WGN Nightside.
Why the voice? Why the voice, man? Why the voice?
Because it's night. That's the nighttime radio.
Is this the nighttime, Bill?
Nighttime, yeah.
Well, you are listening to Kelly Pope and Bill Cressy.
Professor Fraud.
But his name is also Bill Cressy.
It's Bill Cressy, but I trademarked Professor Fraud, so don't anybody else use it. But we've got a guest. I'm calling in from California.
A really cool guest. Like, a super cool guest.
Diane, are you on the line? Hello, Diane. Are you with us?
Yes, I'm with you, Bill.
Okay. Well, this is Diane Capone.
And yes, you heard it.
Yes,
Capone. I'm sort of stunned.
Yeah. Well, this is the great thing about having Diane Capone on. Now, a couple of weeks ago, we had our mutual friend, Diane, John Binder, on. Who's a mobologist out of Oak Park,
which is a real word, by the way.
Yes, it is. And you and John got to know each other, and he gave you a tour.
He did. He has become a great friend. He called me several years ago when he was working on his book, Al Capone and the Beer Wars.
Right.
And he wanted to interview me because he knew that I was still around. And we've always maintained such a private family. You know, we really have not talked publicly about anything all our lives. But John found out about me, and he called, and we started to chat. And in the course of the conversation, I told him that I was actually working on a book of my own. And one thing led to another, and he just has been a wonderful friend and mentor to me. And when we came to Chicago a couple of years ago, my husband and I, he took us on a wonderful tour, including taking me to my grandfather's grave that I had never been to.
Wow. Wow. Well, I tell you, you've written an incredible eye-opener of a book because, you know, as I say to folks, you know, when you think Chicago, what iconic figure do you think of? Now, Kelly Richmond Pope, I asked her that question, and she said Oprah Winfrey.
I said Oprah. I'm sorry. I said Oprah.
But, hey, Kelly, I'm with you. That would be my first thought, too.
But with a lot of people, especially internationally, they think Al Capone.
Or wait, now yeah. They might say President Obama.
Okay.
You think Chicago?
Okay. That's right. And he's okay. Another biggie.
Okay. For old people like me, they'd say Al Capone.
Or they might even say Bill Cressy.
But they might say Professor Fraud, Bill Cressy. But I'll tell you, you go down to Navy Pier, you go down to the tourist shops on Michigan Avenue, you will find T-shirts with Al Capone's photo on it. You will find Al Capone, you know, stuff. Right.
It really is incredible. I mean, I can't believe it. It seems like not so much in California as in Chicago.
Sure.
But I have a friend who's a docent at a museum at Stanford, and she told me that some little school kids came in one time to the museum, and she was going to lead them on a tour, and they asked, well, do you have anything interesting like about Al Capone? These were 10-year-olds, and
wow.
I thought, how would a 10-year-old in California hear that name or know anything about him? But I guess it's because television shows and other kinds of things have really kept his name alive.
Yeah.
In fact, I was just looking at the Al Capone Wikipedia page. Okay. And in it, you know, lists, you know, references or use in the in popular culture. And the thing goes on for pages and pages and pages, you know, and there are like 122 footnotes to the Wikipedia page on Al Capone. It is huge. And as I say now, of course, the Capone family, for all those T-shirts, you get royalties from that, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I don't think. See, that's why you don't see T-shirts with Oprah, because she wants the royalties from it. But Al Capone, you don't have to pay a royalty. Now, you just...
Yeah, no, we have not benefited from all the commercial enterprises that have come about in his name. And that's fine. That's okay.
I was going to say, I got the name of a good lawyer if you want to change your mind on that. But anyway... But speaking of enterprises, you just authored a book with the title Al Capone, Stories My Grandmother Told Me. And just in a couple of minutes right now, we'll have to break for the news at the bottom of the hour. But there's like ideas about Al Capone that people have wrong. Okay. So let me just say a few ideas, and you correct me. You know, that popular myths, if you will. Al Capone. Al Capone was born in Italy.
That's not correct. He was born in New York.
He was born in New York City. Okay.
He was born actually in I believe he was born in Brooklyn, to be specific.
Well, a lot of bad things coming out of Brooklyn and come to Chicago. So he was born in Brooklyn. He grew up in Brooklyn?
He did. He went to school there. His family lived there. And he didn't leave New York until he was around 20. And that's when he made the trip to Chicago.
Okay. And of course, Al Capone was never married, right?
Yes, he was married only once to my wonderful grandmother.
And your grandmother's name was?
Grandma.
Mary Ann Josephine Coughlin, who was always known as May.
Wait a second. The last name was what?
Coughlin. It's an Irish name.
I have a question, and I just want to take like a couple steps back, because this is what I'm curious about. When you go somewhere and you tell people, if you tell people my name is Diane Capone, What do people mm-hmm. respond by saying?
Well, you know, the truth is, I don't typically do that.
Ah.
I've spent my whole life living and keeping a very low profile. That's what my father told us to do. That's what my grandmother wanted us to do. And so I don't typically do that. I worked for 20 years at a college in the Bay Area, and except for a couple of my very closest friends, no one knew that my maiden name was Capone. I live in a lovely community that we moved to when we retired and left the Bay Area, and none of my neighbors knew what my last name was. So I just really haven't talked about it, except to my very closest friends. But when the name does come up, the reaction is almost always the same. Are you kidding me?
Wow.
And people are thrilled. They're very excited.
Well, tell you what, we'll come back with more stories about the Capone family and Al Capone Family Guy right after this.
You are with Kelly Pope and Bill Cressy.
Professor Fraud.
Okay, and tonight we are talking to the granddaughter of Al Capone, Diane Capone, who just authored a new book. Bill, question for you. How did you find her?
Excuse me, Diane, while I talk. Again, it was a mutual friend, John Binder, who helped Diane write her new book, which is titled, by the way, Al Capone, Stories My Grandmother Told Me. And John, this is like small world university here. Diane worked at the university. John was a longtime professor at UIC and was one of my professors in graduate school at UIC.
Ooh, somebody's aging them, dating themselves.
Well, it's a new millennia. I can date whoever I want. But it's staying in touch with John, and John was the one who got me in touch with Diane. So,
well, we're gonna go to news now, and then back with Mrs. Capone.
Okay, I'm dancing in the studio,
and it throws me off every time.
And Kelly does not like my dancing technique.
I think it's fine. So welcome back to True Crime with Kelly Pope
and Professor Fraud, Bill Cressy. Of Governor State University. I always got to say that.
I know you do. I'm happy you do.
Yes,
I'm happy you do. So you found an amazing guest this week.
Yes. Diane, you still there? Hello, Diane.
I'm with you.
Okay. This is Diane Capone, the granddaughter of Al Capone. And before we broke for a break in the news, we were going over like untrue myths about Al Capone. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So we covered that Al was married to your grandmother, known as May.
That's right.
And Al, the stories are either Al had no children or Al had a whole lot of children. How many children were there?
There was one son, my father, mm-hmm. Albert Francis Capone. He was always nicknamed Sonny, and he was born in 1918. My grandfather was very young. My grandfather was still a teenager, and my grandmother had just turned 21. So they were 19 and 21, and a few weeks away from getting married when my father appeared.
Oh, okay. But that was the only child.
And that was the only child.
That was your father, and of course your father was also involved in organized crime, right?
Oh no.
What did your father
not even slightly.
what did your dad do for a living?
Well, he did worked in a number of capacities for a long time. Didn't really have anything that he was, well, really was a good fit for him until it was not an easy thing getting a job as the son of Al Capone when he was using the Capone name.
Right.
And finally, he wound up going into the restaurant business and owned a restaurant for a number of years on Miami Beach called The Grotto.
Okay. Now, Yeah, and this is something, Kelly, that people, I think, aren't aware of, and I was fascinated by. Most people, when they think Al Capone running the gangs of Chicago, you know, and all of that, he must have been, you know, like middle-aged when he was doing that, and he was doing it for decades. But in fact, Al Capone, like, you know, headed up the major, you know, outfit in Chicago at 26.
Yeah.
And he only did it for about 7 years. So
that's right.
Yeah. Tell you what, Diane, this being radio, we got to take another break. So let's go to a break and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to True Crime with Kelly Pope and
Professor Fraud Bill Cressy.
And we have an amazing guest tonight, Diane Capone. Diane, are you with us?
I am with you.
Perfect. So, I'm not surprised that given who you are and just your famous last name, we have a couple people that have asked several questions from our
text line
and call line. So we have a question from a 630 area code wanting to know how you are related to Deidre Capone.
She is a cousin of mine, a second cousin, I believe. She is the daughter of my grand uncle.
Oh, wow. Okay. Okay.
I don't know her very well. I don't know her. I've only met her once in my life, and she never lived in Florida, and so we really never knew each other very well.
I have a question that I wanted to ask, if you don't mind me. A question that I'd asked you before is how it felt to have this last name. And you had described how your family was very private and you were following the advice from your mother and from your grandfather. And that was really to be private and somewhat keep a low profile.
Yes.
My question is, why now write a book? You know, you had said for 20 years you lived and you never really mentioned your relationship or your last name. Why now? Why? What made you decide to take on such a project and share these very, I'm sure, personal and touching details about your family?
Well, I'm delighted you asked that question, Kelly, because the decision to write it all was a difficult one. And I actually started working on this book several years ago, about 7 or 8 years ago. And I've been working on it a long time. It didn't just come about, you know, in the last year or so. But I decided that I wanted the true story of my grandparents to be told. There have been so many stories told that have not been accurate. Some of them have just been real distortions of reality. And I wanted the true story told. And so that was number one. I wanted the facts to be told. And secondly, my sister, my older sister, who was only a year older than me, her name was Ronnie. She passed away about 12 years ago. And when Ronnie died, it really made me realize that I wasn't going to be around forever either. And of the family, my grandparents, my parents, and Ronnie and I was the only one left who could tell this story. But both Ronnie and I were confidants of my grandmother's, and both of us knew my grandfather as very little girls. But I felt I was going to run out of time. Sure. And if I didn't tell the story, nobody else could. And finally, I wanted to really pay tribute to my grandmother, whom I think of as a really extraordinary woman. She went through an awful lot during her life, and she never gave up hope. She never stopped praying for my grandfather. She always believed in him. She always loved him. And I felt that her story needed to be told.
Sure. Another question that came in from one of our listeners, I wanted to ask you this, and this might be a tough one to answer. But as you said, you wanted to tell the true story. You wanted people to know this other side of your grandfather. Writing the book and learning these stories from your mother, were you personally conflicted when you were trying to personify this person that had such a different image than what most people thought of him. So it was almost like two people you were writing about. You're writing about a person that is unknown, yeah. but this big image that everyone knows about him, about yeah. your grandfather, was very different.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, all I can say is I never felt conflicted because I wrote the story of the man that I knew, the man that my grandmother knew. And so it was very easy for me to look back and remember and think about the stories that she always told about him. And his business life was something I knew very little about. You know, as I said, I was a really small child, and by the time I was born, my grandfather's public life was pretty much over. And so, I can't say I felt conflicted at all, but thank you for asking that.
Okay. I'm going to go through a quick summary of the truth about Al Capone. He was leading the Chicago outfit at 26 years old, ran it for only about 7 years. In that time, accumulated a lot of money, but was then convicted of tax evasion. In 33 years old, he went to prison. And by the way, Kelly and I have a lot to be thankful for, because the whole field of forensic accounting, which both of us are involved in, really got a huge boost from the conviction of Al Capone for tax evasion, you know? And the IRS developed forensic accounting.
I'm glad he could help you.
We much appreciate it. And so he goes away. He's in Alcatraz, which still has, you know, tours, and they talk about Al Capone there. But then he was only there for, what is it, about 6-7 years?
No, actually, it was even less than that, Bill. When he went away initially, he went to Atlanta and was in prison there for over 2 years, and then was sent on to Alcatraz, and he was there for about 4.5 years.
Okay.
And so it wasn't even as long as a lot of people think.
Then was released, went to Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore for a while, and then ends up at Palm Island, Miami Beach. And that's where that's where you get to know him. And by then, he was completely out of organized crime.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And had been, obviously, from the time he went away to prison, he was completely removed. And, the last years of his life, he lived another 7 or 8 years after he came home, were very, very happy, peaceful family years. And so thankfully, he also, in those latter years, was able to redeem himself.
Right.
He went back to the Catholic Church. He went to confession. He tried to live the last years of his life to amend, to amend what he had done. And I think he did a wonderful job of it, and he ultimately died in a state of grace and had made peace with God and, I think, with everyone.
I have a question I want to ask you.
Sure.
Your mom, going back to this question of you being conflicted about writing the book, what was it like for your mom to be involved indirectly with his life and the ongoings that he had? I mean, did she ever talk to you about any conflict that she had being attached with a person that had such a double life, if you will?
Well, first of all, let me make sure I'm being clear that I really didn't experience any conflict when I wrote the book. I just want to make sure I didn't misspeak.
Sure. No, you didn't.
Okay. And as far as my grandmother is concerned, most of the stories that I heard from her much later, when I was a grown up, there was very little said about what was going on. You know, in this kind of world, I mean, in the world that my grandfather was in, the women are kept completely removed from it. Mm. So my grandmother lived at the house in Chicago where her mother-in-law lived and the rest of my grandfather's family lived, or several members of the family lived. And my father was born and had come, obviously, to Chicago with my grandmother and grandfather. And so it was a very peaceful existence for the most part. There were a few incidents that I describe in the book that occurred, but for the most part, she was kept completely removed from all of that.
Right. And again, you got to know your grandfather after he got out of prison. You were a very small child. And
yes.
your grandfather died at a fairly young age, you know. The older I get, the younger it seems. He was 48, but your grandmother lived on for many more years.
She lived for another 40 years.
Yeah. So these are stories. So this book, again, called Al Capone, Stories My Grandmother Told Me. These were stories that you and your grandmother were very close, and she told you all of these stories. And you get this other side of Al Capone, if you will, Al Capone Family Guy.
That's really very true. And the stories also, while my grandmother, I mention her specifically, that she's the one who told me the stories, many of the stories came from my father and also my mom. My mother kept diaries, and my mother died very prematurely also. She was just barely 70. And after she died, my sisters and I found all these journals that she'd kept. And when she describes first meeting my grandfather and her life in the family and how wonderful he was to her, it's a very, very different view than most people have any idea of.
Wow. Now, I mentioned that your grandfather was a tenant, a guest at Alcatraz Island. And you're going to be out there shortly signing copies of your book.
Yes. Actually, probably sometime the latter part of January. Actually, it's really, this is, talk about opening up a whole new way of living. Going from not talking about my family at all, now I'm going to be talking both at the Mob Museum in Las Vegas wants me to come out and do a presentation in January. Alcatraz wants me to come and do book signing there also probably the latter part of January. And so, yeah, I'm going to be talking a good bit about my family.
Well, speaking of which, even sooner, this Friday, you're coming out here, the Chicagoland area, to Anderson's Bookshop in LaGrange for a book signing Friday night at about 7 o'clock. So,
yes, exactly.
You know, so as I say, we've had a number of people calling in to the or texting in. I'll throw in that the text line here at WGN, which is 312-981-7200. And we've got a lot of people. I think you're going to get a pretty good crowd from the interest just that this interview is showing. So,
I'm delighted. And I have to say, Anderson's has already called me and told me to order more books, to have more books sent in, because they have gotten a lot of calls. And so if people are interested in going, I suggest they give them a call ahead of time and make sure they have a book on reserve for them.
Well, I tell you, because, you know, you've kindly sent me an advanced copy of the book, and I read it, and it's fascinating insights into the human being that was Al Capone, and also what he became when he got released from prison, and he was a total different person from what you described. So,
I'm delighted that you enjoyed the book, and I hope that Kelly will have an opportunity to look it over as well.
I've done it.
I shared it with her too. Yeah.
Oh, good.
Okay. Yeah. Again, for anyone listening and the folks calling in, if you're interested at all, go out to LaGrange, which is the western suburbs, which is near Oak Park, where a lot of mobsters lived. But at Anderson's Bookshop in LaGrange at 26 South LaGrange Road, right in the heart of LaGrange. And that's this Friday, October 25 at 7 p.m. Diane Capone will be there signing copies of her new book, Al Capone, Stories My Grandmother Told Me. I mean, it's a really fascinating read. And I'll tell you, you're a good writer. You know?
Well, thank you. Well, that's lovely to hear.
Well, you really, it's a really interesting, fun read. So, anyway.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
And Diane, thank you so much for just being so transparent and opening an aspect of your life to be a part of this conversation. As you know, people have been mesmerized 100 years later about this. So thank you so much for just having the courage to do this.
And thank you for joining us on WGN Nightside. Okay. And I'll see.
It was my pleasure.
I'll see you in LaGrange. Okay.
I'll look forward to it. Bye-bye now.
We are back. True Crime with Kelly Pope and Dancing Bill Cressy.
That's Professor Fraud Dancing Bill Cressy.
All right.
Governor State University. Yes. Okay. Time to throw that in.
I know. So that was a fun first hour. We're going to switch gears a little bit.
Because you can't beat fun like talking to the granddaughter of a ruthless mobster, you know.
So, you know, I normally get nervous when there's two attorneys in the room. Our next guest is
frankly, everyone should get nervous if there's two attorneys in the room.
So our next guest is a real estate attorney and friend of mine. Her name is Alexis Hart McDowell. And I wanted her to join us because, of course, you know, we love scams, frauds, and dupes, and we love to follow them. Mm-hmm. But she posted on Instagram a few weeks ago about these, how celebrities are being used for these real estate workshops. And the reason why I was interested in her post is because I saw this this advertisement called Rules of Renovation.
Oh,
and
sure.
It is a workshop with Hilary Farr from Love It or List It. And me and my friends love watching Love It or List It, you know. And then, so I was like, oh, you know, maybe we should go to this so we can hear what her tips are. And then I saw Alexis' post and I was like, So maybe she's just a patsy for some really big fraud scheme. So she posted that. And so I wanted her to come on the show and just sort to talk about this message that she was posting and more information about that and then what she does.
Okay. Well, Alexis, are you out there? Are you joining us?
I sure am. Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
Hey, Alexis, how are you?
I'm great, Kelly. Just great. Thanks so much for having me on. Bill, nice to speak with you.
Nice to speak with you, too. So you're a real estate attorney. I'm also an attorney. I've done some real estate. So
Does that make you a real estate attorney?
No, not really.
So let's
take the next hour and talk about line by line what we go over at a closing.
No.
Oh, okay.
No.
But Alexis, let me tell you, I was really interested in these seminars. You know, like there's one, you know, you see all these reality TV stars now doing these workshops around the country. And I seriously was interested in the one with Hilary Farr, The Rules of Renovation, until I saw your post.
Yes.
So talk to me.
Yes, and she's actually one of the people named, well, she's not a named defendant, but the FTC went so far as to name specific people from HGTV and the A&E show Flipping Boston. And unfortunately, Hilary Farr is one of the names in the complaint. She's not a named defendant, but she's one of the names in the complaint.
So, and the complaint is from the FTC?
And tell us who the FTC
is. The Federal Trade Commission. Okay. So they protect consumers, and they tell us what is considered an unfair or deceptive business practice.
Okay. So what was going on? What is unfair about this practice?
So it's the setup of the real estate investment courses themselves. And just to let you all know, I actually had a client who
before she met me, went into one of these seminars, bought this stuff, and spent upwards of $40,000.
$40,000?
$40,000. And to this day, has not bought, flipped, or invested in a piece of real estate. And this is after attending one of these seminars. And the seminar she attended is actually named in this complaint as well. But back to your question, Kelly. So what they're doing is, just like you got caught up in the free event, hey, you see the flyers, you see the promotions, you see the HGTV and the A&E stars. And it's like, come out to this free event. You're going to learn everything you need to know about real estate investing and using other people's money and all of this other stuff, right?
Yeah.
So you show up to the free event. A lot of people felt like that they were actually going to meet the HGTV star or the A&E star.
And you don't?
The case you usually, no, no, ma'am. They've got more revenue generating activities to do.
There you go. So they're busy flipping houses.
And it's a video.
No. It's a video of them.
Yes.
Say it ain't so, Alexis. No.
Yes, you would have been very upset, Kelly, had you attended.
If I didn't see Hillary in the flesh, I would have been angry.
You were not.
Okay, speaking for
you would have to take a picture with a cardboard picture of her.
Okay, speaking for millions of husbands out there, don't allow your wives to watch HGTV.
So first of all, you get to the free event. They're not there. You get a video intro welcome. Then they have these trainers come out. So what the FTC says in their complaint is that it was misleading for the free event because they say that you're going to learn everything you need to know about real estate investing and other people's using other people's money. And really, you get there and they're going to sell you on their three-day course.
Ah, so you really can't learn everything to do with real estate investing in like 4 hours.
Bill, give me your credit card. I'm going to sign up.
Not.
I'm going to sign up for this event. Bill, give me your credit card. It says register for an event. Meet Hillary Farr. And it said, give me your credit card.
No, not going to happen, Kelly. Not going to happen. I'll give you the one that's got somebody else's name on it. You know, I'm Professor Fraud. I've got several identities. Yes. Wow. So you sign up for the 3-day course, which is also free, right?
Wait, but Alexis.
Absolutely.
Alexis.
Not, Bill. Oh, my God. They've got to make some money somewhere, right?
But Alexis, it says, wait. It says Hillary Farr's rules of renovation will show you how to increase the value of properties through innovative and cost effective strategies. It doesn't say anything about selling me on another course.
Well, they don't say it.
Oh, no, of course not. But, and that's what the FTC considers misleading. So after you get to the one-day course, they say, oh, okay, well, great. We're so glad you're here. We're glad you're interested. But you really can't learn everything in these couple of hours. Mm-hmm. So get into our three-day course, which is typically $5,997.
Well, at least it's not $6,000.
Yes.
No, it's $5,997. Yeah, wow, there you go.
This is interesting to me because as you're talking, I'm reading this Rules of Renovation website, and this is what it says when you keep clicking. At this event, you will see how you can locate properties, build income streams, execute a wholesale deal. They don't say anything about Hillary being there.
No, they do not. Mm-hmm.
But her face is plastered everywhere.
So it's truthful.
Yes, it's just a celebrity endorsement.
Now, I take it she's a paid endorser.
Oh, of course they receive money from
her. Do they have a disclaimer that she's a paid endorser and doesn't know what the heck they're doing? So something like that?
The FTC doesn't say anything about disclaimers for endorsements or anything like that.
Okay. Wait a minute.
But,
wait a second. Alexis.
You should see that look on Kelly's face right
Listen
now.
Listen to this.
She just read something.
This is it. It says that while Hillary is unable to personally attend all events, the Rules of Renovation team will be presenting strategies on her behalf in small print.
Of course, that's where you put all the important stuff, right?
That's
lesson one in law school, right, Alexis? You put the important stuff
in the
footnotes.
It's like the footer of an audited financial statement, Kelly. Put the small stuff in there.
There you go. It's in the footnotes. So, now, it's... again, we don't want to, you know, cast aspersions. So this is all allegations and an FTC complaint. But
Yes.
Wow. So you mean all these things I get in the mail or online that tell me, you know, I can come and let's face it, this real estate flipping thing is just the tip of the iceberg. There's the presentations on timeshares, there's the presentations on various other real estate and investment tools. And if they tell you, oh, well, you'll learn everything in 4 hours and we'll give you a free steak dinner or whatever, you know, there are a lot of people out there who have taken and learned this stuff over years, taken graduate courses and all these other things. You're really not going to learn it all in 4 hours.
You're absolutely not. But you have people out here who are trying to increase their economic status, and when they see and hear things like that, they feel as though that is probably the best opportunity for them. Some of them are in desperate situations as well. Yeah. You know, they can have medical bills or taking care of older parents or losing their home, and they're really trying to find an avenue, a legal, legitimate way that they feel is legal and legitimate, to make some money in order to, you know, basically live. And they get caught up in these.
But let me ask you guys this. Who's at fault? Is it the fault of the celebrity being paid to be the endorser of these programs? Or is it the fault of the consumer thinking that they're going to learn all of this in 4 hours? Who's at fault?
I think it's actually a third person you didn't name, Kelly, and that is the educational companies that put these things together. So you have these real estate investment education companies. One, they're named in the complaint. One of them is called Success Path. They have various names. And, you know, they have the programs that they put together, and they kind of just slap the celebrities' endorsements on them with their approval, you know. And so they are the ones who, you know, are running afoul of the laws. They are the ones who are actually scamming the consumers.
So, Alexis, we're going to take a break, but I want to keep this conversation going after the break. Can you hang on with us?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Our house in the middle of our street. Our house in the middle of our street.
Observing.
It's dancing Bill Cressy here.
A human being moving, making movements at 11:21 at night. So this is Kelly Pope and Bill Cressy.
Professor Fraud. And I'm an attorney. And on the line, we've got another attorney, a real estate specialist, Alexis. Are you there?
I'm here.
Yay!
Alexis, thank you again for joining us and talking to us about the FTC and this issue with using celebrities to lure people in for these real estate workshops. And so before we took our break, we were about to say who's at fault. And I have posed two options. One was, is it the celebrity who agrees and takes in the money, the endorsement?
Mm-hmm.
Is it the people who sign up to think that they're going to learn everything you need to learn in 4 hours? And you had posed another person, and that was the educational company. Are they at fault?
Yes.
Well, they're the ones who's really making the money off of this thing. The celebrity got paid to do this, you know, promotion, and probably was, I'm guessing, guaranteed that they would put some kind of, you know, disclaimer on everything, saying that they're only here as, you know, as a celebrity endorser, and they may not be actually appearing at the stuff. So they probably think, hey, that's pretty cool. I've gotten to the point where all I have to do is show up and tape something for a couple hours, and I get paid a big chunk of money. And by the way, if anyone wants Professor Fraud, for that kind of work, But yeah, these quote unquote educational companies, and you know, are making a lot of money off of this. You got one client spent how much?
Over $40,000.
Now, why did your client do that, Alexis?
Because they earnestly felt that this was going to be an opportunity for them to increase their financial status, to change it around. And they fell for the promises of the company. And I talked to them extensively, well, why? What was it about it that made you go for it? He said, well, they pulled us to the side. They told us, you know, they're going to walk us through it. I wrote everything down. They're going to hold our hand. They're going to get us through it. We're going to get this mentor. And that's a huge selling thing to some people because they think they have someone who's going to help them if they get this package. And it turned out, you know, yeah, they sent them a mentor who, one, didn't even live in the city, let alone understand the real estate market of where they live. And then, two, you know, they wanted to do a certain type of real estate investing, which was wholesaling or flipping. And when the mentor flew in from whatever state they came from,
Alexis, we're gonna put you on hold for a quick second just because there's a little bit of breakup, okay, on your end.
On your cell. So, but if anyone out there has been involved in one of these scams,
feel free to join our conversation. Call in or text in at 312-981-7200.
Yeah. No, this is a problem. And I tell you, you know, it's 11:24 at night. And if you flip around, if you got cable TV, especially flip around any of the channels from you know, now until dawn, you will see a lot of these promotional commercials out there promoting various types of investment. I'll call them schemes, but that often has a bad, you know, implication. But really, investment ideas, especially real estate, is a big one. And some are perfectly legitimate. Okay. But we have these other kinds that all they're trying to do is lure you in, sit you in a room for a couple of hours, and then have you pay $5,000 to do it.
So, Alexis, back to your client. Okay, so your client, she was describing the scene, what they do, what they say, and how they lure you in. But how do you get to the point of saying, here's my credit card, I'm going to write a check, and then later you're out $40,000? Like, tell me how that happens.
Yeah, they, you know, basically sold them on having someone walk them through the process. And when you feel as though you have a professional by your side, then you think that that $47,000 is worth it. And unfortunately, it turned out not to be. And then they give you this list of packages, and you know how it goes. Pick the biggest package, pick the smallest package. They're all ridiculously priced. And they, when you really read the fine print, they don't really do anything for you.
Yeah, and often they say, and this person invested $500 in a house and it sold for $95,000 or something, right? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And Bill, that is absolutely one of the issues in the complaint as well, is that you can't make those unsubstantiated earnings claims, right? You know, and that'll run afoul of the FTC law.
Yeah.
That's exactly what they did.
Yeah, no, there's sadly, as I say, there are people who've done quite well in real estate. And there are some educational folks who do really nice jobs training people in real estate. But there are a lot of scamsters out there.
Yes, there are.
We're going to take a break because I have a true confession. I'm shocked at myself that I was about to click register here for Hillary. I'm just shocked at myself.
So, and using my credit card, too.
And using your credit card. So we're going to come back and you can join us after the break.
Yes, I can.
Okay, thanks. We are back.
It's WGN Nightside. And this is True Crimes with Dr. Kelly Pope. And
Bill Cressy,
Professor Fraud. How are you doing, everybody? It's Professor Fraud here.
So,
speaking of fraud,
we have a guest on the line, Alexis Hart McDowell, attorney Alexis Hart McDowell. And she was talking to us about a recent issue that the Federal Trade Commission has gotten involved in with these real estate using
celebrities to promote real estate educational seminars that are heavy on the money you're paying and light on the seminar, maybe.
Well, but and so
that is correct.
So this is a question, though, Alexis. So we were talking about your client who found themselves $40,000 in the hole. And I guess I wonder, you know, It didn't happen all at once. So I guess it happened gradually. And then she realized, or he realized, that I haven't earned anything and I've invested all this money. But who forced the hand to write the check, or how did it happen?
It wasn't over time, Kelly. It was one check.
Really?
Yes. So that's how their salespeople work. They have packages, a diamond, a platinum, a gold, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, if you show up to the seminar, it costs X amount of dollars, but since you're at the seminar, they discount it for Y amount of dollars, you know? And the package that they got was, like, originally $74,000, but because you're at the seminar and if you buy it today, it's $42,000.
There you go. And you're going to be making multiple times that much with all this real estate you're going to be flipping.
Absolutely. Right? And with the people that they're giving you, the mentors, the programming, the software. I mean, how could you lose? And then you top that with the earnings claims that they're saying you're going to make in the first 6 months or even 3 months. You know, you're feeling like, how can I not lose? And that's what they're selling you. They're telling people they're going to get 100% financing, you know? And if someone's going to give you all the money, then you're not out of anything, right?
So do you think your client will recover their money?
I do not. It pains me to say that. It really, really does, because I hate when people get taken advantage of.
There's no easy money. If it looks too good to be true,
easy money.
It's not. If I may, how old were these folks?
I want to say in their 40s.
Okay. Because I was just wondering.
Late 30s, early 40s.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, they might be fairly young because, you know, 2008 and the real estate collapse back then, it might be far enough in the rearview mirrors that people have forgotten what took place there. So I think everyone should go out and rent a copy of The Big Short and watch that right after they watch All the Queen's Horses, of course, you know. Yeah.
But Bill, to your point, you know, it's not the younger people who have $40,000 sitting around for the most part. So it is the middle-aged people, I'll call them, because I kind of fall into that bracket, you know, that have that money and are willing to invest it.
Wow.
So what other types of real estate scams have you seen or are you following?
I follow when people steal people's homes.
Bill just talked about that.
We were talking about that during the break, and the people who, you know, file phony quitclaim deeds or whatever.
Absolutely.
And steal your home from out under you.
Let's talk about this. So first, talk about what the scam is and how you can protect yourself from it.
And not that we're trying to teach anyone how to do it, but you have to understand how it's done so you can protect yourself.
Yeah, so sometimes it happens. It's really what I call an elderly crime. They really prey on the elderly with this because elderly don't always have the protectors that they need, and they don't always comprehend what it is that they're signing. And sometimes it's family members or even close friends who pull this over on our elderly citizens. And they get them to sign a deed. They tell them it's something else, or I need to do this in order to get you money to do your house. And then they end up selling the house out from under them. And they get them to sign a quitclaim deed, and then they sell the house to someone else because they own it now. Right. And then the owner, the elderly person, comes up and they've got nothing. And they've worked their whole life, and this is the house that they were going to be in, and now they've got nothing.
Yeah.
And they have no defense?
I mean, they have a defense, but Bill knows what it can take to demand a defense.
Yeah, you have to prove the fraud. And so they signed this.
And you have to have money to go to court to do that. And a lot of elderly people don't have it.
And I'll tell you, I worked with some folks in the Special Victims Unit of the Chicago Police who do crimes against the elderly. And one of the problems and one of the reasons that elderly are targeted is because they're afraid to tell their families. Because they're afraid their families will think, well, they're no longer competent, and, you know, and so for that fear, they don't even report the crime sometimes, you know?
Nope. So you're absolutely correct, though. I have another scam for you, Kelly. Another client of mine called me, and her mother is elderly, and she was going into the grocery store, and this is written on a couple of different blogs and stuff, and another set of elderly people came up to them, or older people, and said, hey, we found this check for you know, $20,000 by your car.
The pigeon drop.
Come with us to go cash it and get a portion of it.
Yeah, that's the pigeon drop,
that
right?
Yes. Oh, poor
thing. It's the pigeon drop, and they've been doing it to elderly people. And my client's mother actually fell for this, and they took her. She got in their car, took her to two different banks. She got the money out, gave it to them, and then, of course, they were gone.
Alexis. First of all, let's do some stats on this. I'm curious. How old are the elderly that we're talking about?
The ones I'm talking about is in their 80s.
Oh, yeah. So is it the fact that we're talking about a generation that is just trusting and they believe that you are who you say you are? Like, why would you ever lie to me about this? I mean, I can't imagine my grandmother, if she were alive, getting in the car with someone she did not know. And going to the bank with someone she did not know and withdrawing money and giving money or sharing. I can't even imagine.
Well, if I could, Alexis, and there's a lot of thinking that is because of a generational difference. But there are a lot of people who are younger that fall for the pigeon drop, except that the older folks are the ones who might have. You want to target folks that have the money, who can do something
in the bank?
Like this.
Yeah. Absolutely, that's the whole point of targeting them. And Kelly, I think that it is the level of sophistication with these scams. If they've been on this earth 80 years, they've seen a lot of different things. But with technology, with paperwork being duplicated, with
Photoshop,
older people are doing it. They're not used to the level of sophistication of these things going on now, and they get caught up in it.
Yeah. If anyone out there listening, feel free to call or text us to join in the conversation at 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. And there's a lot of scams being perpetrated out there, and a lot of them are tied into real estate.
I want to go back to this pigeon drop. So you're saying that a check is found by your car, and
yes.
I think this. So the check is found by your car. What's the dialogue to say, let's go cash it and you can have some of it? Is that what the dialogue is?
No. Well, Alexis, play along. Is that, and so if I'm the scammer, I'm the fraudster, and I approach Kelly and say, hey, Kelly, this was found next to your car. You know what the law is. If we take it in to the bank, and I'll walk it in because I know how this works. I'll walk it into the bank, and if we put money down with it, if no one claims the check in 30 days, we get to split the whole check. But we need you to put down $10,000. I'll put down $10,000. You stay out here in the car. I'll go into the bank, and I'll make the arrangement. And boom, in 30 days, we'll have $50,000.
But you're a stranger. You're talking, I don't know anything about you, and everything that you just said, you're a stranger to me.
Oh, but they're good at this. They are good.
I don't care. I don't know you.
I got approached by someone in Menards nothing against Menards, are a great, great company, but a guy approached me in Menards, and I let him run his scam just because I wanted to appreciate, and at the end I said, I'm Professor Fraud. I know exactly what you're doing, but I just wanted to let you do your spiel because he was very convincing.
Oh no!
Yeah, well, that's because you're old and
crusty.
No, it's
not. Because I just was about to sign up for Hillary Farr scandal.
There you go.
But at least I can at least say I didn't read the fine print. Now I will say it took me four register for this event screens to get to the point to see. That she wasn't going to be there. And it said it in very faint lettering. It did say it. Mm-hmm. But some complete stranger walks up to me and says the line that you just said.
Yep.
That sounds suspicious.
And they're holding in their hand a check for $100,000.
Alexis, I'm not buying.
Yes.
Well.
That's exactly what Bill said is exactly what happens.
Yeah.
And they fall for it.
And it's been going on for probably for centuries, but I know at least for decades. It's called the pigeon drop, and
you sound like you know from experience.
I study this because I'm Professor Fraud.
Oh my goodness!
Yes, but no, it's a very common scam, and a good scamster can get you to go along with it. And the idea is, we both put up some money. And, of course, they're not putting up any money, but they take your check. And, of course, you'll stay out of the bank. Well, I'll go into the bank and make the arrangements. And they go in the bank, cash the check, and then the money is in their pocket, and they blow out of there. I mean, they're not, they move on to the next town and the next pigeon. So,
wow.
Yeah. Right? Am I right, Alexis? You'll back me up on this.
That's
right?
Exactly what happens. And then, they change the story up, too. They'll change it to, you know, make a donation to charity and stuff like that. So that's been documented as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's good stuff.
Yeah. I just go back to who's to blame. And it, that's a really tough question because, you know, one of the things that we all want people to be is ethical. And, you know, if the celebrity representative isn't ethical, who's ethical?
Yeah. But I tell you what, we'll talk more about this after our break.
We are back. True Crime with Kelly Richmond Pope.
And Professor Fraud, Bill Cressy of Governor State University.
And this past hour, we've been talking about real estate scams. Yep. And we just, before the break, we finished a conversation about the pigeon drop, which I am just mesmerized by because there's so many steps that have to happen in order for a person to be lured into this scam. So we have Alexis Hart McDowell on the line with us. Alexis, are you there?
Alexis, are you still with us?
I'm here. Good evening, everybody.
Hello. Hello, Alexis. Yeah, we're talking about the pigeon drop, and Kelly feels that nobody would fall for this, and why would somebody try it? But
that's not what I said.
Okay.
That's not what I said.
One, the scamsters...
I said I was mesmerized by it. What I said.
And the scamsters are good at convincing people, and the kind of money they're making, you know, they might approach, you know, 40 different people, but all they need to find is one that falls for it.
I mean, I think what's interesting about this, when I think about the IRS phone scams that happen ever around tax season, is at least they are impersonating a legitimate entity. Mm-hmm. With this, what you're describing, it is absolutely a stranger walking up to you thinking or saying to you, yes, I have this in hand and I think you could benefit from it too. So that's what I think I'm mesmerized by, is our willingness to trust.
Well, the guy that approached me in a hardware store, okay, what he did was, it was brilliant. He was good at it, was convince me that I knew who he was.
Oh, come on.
Hey, he was like, hey, is
that
you?
That's great.
Yeah, is that you? Hey, I haven't seen you in a long time. You still living over there?
I wish you could see my face right now. Like
And he was, I mean, he was good. I let him play it out, you know? And actually, for a short time, I thought, oh, is this a former student of mine?
No.
You know? And, but he was good. And so he convinced you that he was not a total stranger. But, you know, guess what? I thought that was your car out in the parking lot. I found this check next to it.
No.
And you and I...
No.
Well...
Stop it.
Well, okay. See, you've been
that would be
studying...
That would be me standing and talking to this person at Menards. Just stop it.
Says the person who almost bought into a real estate seminar.
Only because she was representing... She was impersonating herself.
Well, and again, if I could say... A lot of reputable real estate seminars, training programs, and all the rest. But unfortunately, as in every field, there are scamsters out there. So
we actually have a caller on the line named Glenn. Glenn, hey, welcome to the show.
Hi, evening. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
My wife got one of those checks about 3-4 years ago. Mm. It's $5,000. See, it's just cash. It's yours. Yep. You know, and I knew it was a scam right off because it's too good to be true. It is.
So, yeah, now you're right. Now, that's a different type of scam, though. Like, that's
slightly.
That's when a check comes. Yeah, I understand those, Glenn. Yeah, and that happens a lot, too.
Yeah, in fact, go ahead.
But I called my banker and I asked her, well, what would happen if I cash it? Yeah. She says, well, it's legal to cash it. But the problem is, I know that people would take the money out. And curiosity was going to get the better of me and say, well, I'll cash it, but leave the money in the bank.
Right.
And see what I was just curious to see what would happen. But I just decide just to tear it up.
Yeah, no, that, yeah, smart move, Glenn. Smart move.
So Glenn, what do you think about this? What we're talking about here, where someone approaches you in a parking lot and says, "I found this check by your car. Let's go to the bank together and cash it."
Oh, I would run as far as I could run as fast as I could.
It's a $100,000 check, though, Glenn.
No, I don't care. Okay. I would say, here, I'll take it into my bank and see what happens. You wait in the car. I would end up calling the police and reporting them.
Well, I guess I'm not going to be sending you that check then, Glenn.
Thanks, Glenn, so much for joining us and adding your story. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Have a nice evening.
You too. We have another caller who's on the line that wants to also share a similar experience.
Hello.
Hey, Doc. Hello. Yeah,
I was just going to comment. One of my favorite movies is House of Games, written by David Mamet, starring Joe Mantegna and Lindsay Krause. And these guys are con men. I was wondering if you'd seen it.
Yes, it's a fabulous movie, you know, created by a bunch of Chicagoans, and it really shows the professional con men out there. They're good at what they do. And
there's the scene where they're going to con William H. Macy at a Western Union, and Joe Mantegna tells Lindsey Krause, he said, "Watch this. I'm going to go up and place my confidence in this person, a complete stranger, and in a little bit, there'll be a situation arise to where he'll have no choice but to put his confidence then back in me."
That's, you know, it's true. And, you know, it's amazing. It's something about the human condition where we will place our trust in people, even if they were perfect strangers to us 5 minutes before. And in a few moments, in a few minutes, a con man can convince you that they are your best friends for life. And sure, I will do whatever you ask me to do. So it's out there, Kelly. Kelly's looking at me, giving me the side eye. But
no, I wasn't giving you the side eye.
Okay. But I think it's time for us to take another break. So let's take a break.
Oh, yeah.
Mike, so I was a little concerned about this opening with this music because I did not know how my co-host Bill Cressy's body was about to move.
Oh, well,
and now that you're playing this music, I'm even more concerned.
This is the instrumental version of a hit song by Shaggy.
But what you're doing is something different.
I tell you, you know,
Midnight, right?
It's midnight.
You know, you can see this all on WGNRadio.com too. We're streaming live,
so
and people can then text in their scores of my dancing.
dancing with the professor.
981-7200 312-981-7200
Let's see some moves.
Yeah. Let's hear the music again. There you go. Okay. Now, why? First of all. Okay, that's over there, for people watching, the woman over there, that's Dr. Kelly Richmond Pope, and I am Professor Fraud, Bill Cressy.
And as the night progresses, you get more animated, and you move even faster with this. I can't even talk anymore.
And speaking of animated, this is not the Shaggy from the Scooby-Doo cartoon either.
So we're playing this song for a reason. Who would have ever thought that Shaggy would be involved in a scam?
His persona. And of course, if anybody who saw Shaggy performing with Sting this summer at Ravinia, the reviews were pretty good.
Okay, so I'll just say this. I didn't even know Shaggy was still performing. I will say this. I will say it for the listeners that have never heard of this song or that forgot about it.
Say, Professor Fraud is hip. Okay.
Oh, we see that.
Yeah,
we totally see that. Mike sees it too.
Or maybe
he's very hip.
Or maybe it's a hip replacement. Okay. this is the third hour of our usual broadcasts here on WGN Nightside, True Crime. And this is what we call the Dupe of the Week segment, where we talk about some recent and current scams. And this is one that's out there right now, where Shaggy is warning his fans that someone is out there posing as him in an apparent effort to scam the way into money.
I'm trying to check. I'm trying to tweet to Shaggy and let him know that we're talking about him.
Yeah,
and
okay.
You're singing about him.
Yeah, I know. You're probably very close to Shaggy, and you know, so send him a personal email. Now, you were in the last segment. We're talking about, you know, how can people fall for these things? According to Shaggy, the scamming involves hitting up fans to tell them they somehow owe Shaggy money. So, using social media, they locate fans of Shaggy, and then faux Shaggy, if you want to call it that, faux Shaggy is sending them a message on social media saying, oh, by the way, you owe me money. How? What? And you know what? They're sending it in. So Shaggy, the real Shaggy, is now urging his followers to refrain from engaging with these fraudulent social media accounts in any way, shape, or form. So in the words of Shaggy's hit song, Shaggy would say, it wasn't me. See, that was a joke. Okay, that's the name of that song we're playing. There we go. That's right. And it's the instrumental version of It Wasn't Me, because I'm not sure even after midnight we could play the lyric version. But Shaggy is extremely generous. He's raised hundreds of millions of dollars for Bustamante Hospital, which I believe is down in Jamaica where he's from. But he's been very, very busy, and somebody is using his name.
Well, and what I did people. Just to be a part of the help,
yes.
I just sent a tweet to Shaggy.
Okay.
At the real Shaggy.
Real Shaggy.
Duh. I told you you weren't cool. The real Shaggy. D-I.
Okay.
Okay. Anyhow, I sent it, and I said that we are currently talking about hashtag the Shaggy scam on at WGN Radio 720.
Well, you know what? That was very, very wise of you to do that, because so if you're a fan of the real Shaggy.
So hold on.
Uh-huh.
If the real Shaggy is listening.
Yes.
We are trying to warn people about your scam
yes.
using your image, your yes. person.
Right.
And if you are out there, we would love to talk to you. So feel free to call or text and to join this conversation at 312-981-7200. We will even play the song when you call.
And Michael, being our crack producer, who's also a musician, he would know whoever calls in identifying themselves as Shaggy. He'll know if it's the real Shaggy or not.
How will he know?
Yeah, but well, because it's Michael.
I'd probably ask him, and he'd probably say it wasn't me.
There you go.
Oh my god! Oh my god! This is spreading.
Exactly. Oh, but we have so many more scams this week to talk about. Okay,
we do. That was a good starter, though. Like
that one comes with music.
Yeah, I mean. When I saw this, I was like, wow, Shaggy. And then you tell me about the stings. I'm like, I'm out of this.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I hope he calls.
Yeah, you got to be hip there.
Because we're trying to help him and help
his
fan base.
And his fan base. Because, and maybe he could have his whole fan base start listening.
True crime
on 720 AM WGN Radio or WGNRadio.com live streaming.
And if you live stream and the real Shaggy calls, you will see Bill Cressy dancing to your song.
There you go. I mean, that's worth the price of admission. And what do we charge? Oh, yeah, nothing. Yeah.
So let's talk. What else do we have on the desk today?
Well, this is one that our good friends at the Better Business Bureau are warning people about. And it's scammers using bogus search results to fool your voice assistants.
Now, that one, this is a good one. Like, no, on the dupe of the week meter that we just made up about a second ago.
Okay.
On a scale from 1 to 10, the dupe of the week meter, I give this one a 10, because I refuse to have an Alexa in my house. We don't have any of these voice assistants. I don't have Alexa. What's the other kind that you could have?
Yeah, that's the Google one. I've got Alexa.
Okay.
I love my Alexa.
Okay, so the next time you talk into your Alexa and say, "Hey Alexa, I want to make some plane tickets." Be careful.
Oh, well, I don't do that. I'm like, Alexa, turn on the lights. Yeah, that's okay, as far as I've gotten at.
So tell us about what's going on with these voice assistants.
But let me ask you, you've got a cell phone over there. What kind is that?
I'm not saying.
Oh, okay. But do you ever use the voice assistant on that?
Nope.
Aha. Okay, but a lot of people do.
Okay, a lot of people
do. They hit the little microphone icon and they ask it something or whatever.
Like, voice, tell me or call such and such number. Call pizza. I want to order some pizza.
I want to order some pizza. But maybe you'd say, maybe you have a problem with your, maybe with your bank account. You know.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. Okay.
Call my bank. You know, Chase, or call.
Why would you ask Alexa to call the bank for you and then give Alexa your bank account number?
Because, I don't know, you're driving. You know, or whatever reason, because we've become addicted to the convenience.
Okay. All right. So we speak into Alexa and we say, Alexa, Bill's bank account number is 1-0.
Yeah, there you go. Well, actually, what the Better Business Bureau is saying is that folks are setting up bogus sites for the support numbers of well-known brands. So let's say call Whirlpool support because something's going wrong with your dishwasher.
Sure.
Okay. I'm not saying Whirlpool's involved in this. I'm just pulling that out of the air. Okay. And so, but what the fake folks have done, the scamsters, the dupers, the how are you going to call them, the fraudsters, have done is they've set up a fake Whirlpool site and then hit it a lot themselves, and then it suddenly raises up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when you tell
Alexa
or your Google to, you know, get me the phone number for Whirlpool support, the fake site comes up first. And then you say, call, and you call, and now you're talking to a fraudster.
Because guess what? There's no way to verify it.
Nope.
There are no internal controls around this. How are you going to verify? The only reason why we know that's Mike's voice is because we see Mike.
Then again, it could be a hologram, you know. Are you real over there, Michael?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. But, you know, if you were in front of the computer, you know, you could see, you know, that the name of the web address is www.whirlpool.com. But the fake site might be different. And so then at least you'd be able to say, oh, that's not the right site. I want this one. If you're using a voice assistant, you don't see it. Just say, call. It's the fraudster picks up and goes, oh, you know, what's your problem? I'm having a problem with my dishwasher. Oh, well, we can send somebody out there. But we need...
your address.
Your address, your social security number. Your bank account. Hey,
Give you your credit card number. Because you have to pay $59.95 for the service charge.
You got it. So we need that money up front before we send a guy out. And now you've got they hit the credit limit on your credit card because they're buying all sorts of stuff.
It's a brilliant scam.
Well, that's the fun, if you will, of our careers. Being professors of forensic accounting, fraud examination, all this kind of stuff, is we're constantly watching all these ingenious scams that people come up with. You know, as I said, if we were teaching 14th century French literature, you know, they're not making any more of that. So in studying fraud, we're constantly, it's this battle of wits with folks out there coming up with ingenious ways of trying to separate us from our money. And this is ingenious, you know?
It's a good one. So I gave it a 10. What'd you give it?
9.5.
Of course. You just can't agree with me, right?
Well, no. I'm a tough grader, as my students would tell you, you know?
What you got over there?
Okay, I got another one. Okay. You and I have seen horrible frauds where people are willing to kill to perpetrate the fraud. There have been
which is also called red collar crime.
Red collar crime.
Exactly. We should talk about that and have Rich Brody back on one day.
Okay. And I know I have a friend with ATF who has stories of people who commit like arson, and to make it more believable, we'll have someone in the building, okay, so that they can find a body in there, you know. But now this is a different kind of scam where the scamsters didn't kill someone, but actually kept someone alive in order to perpetrate the fraud.
Wow.
How'd that work, huh?
So cooking the books with...
with a body, with a human being. So Do we need to take a break right now?
Or I we think keep we do. Talking? We can take a break.
Okay, let's take a break right now. And when we come back, a fraud where we keep someone alive.
Okay, so, Mike, what's going on? Do you see this man in here with me?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no, please. No, no.
Yes,
okay.
I do.
Thank you. Okay, I'm glad that there is a witness, and hopefully people are watching online.
It's Professor Reggae. I'm changing my name from Professor Fraud.
Yeah. So thanks for joining us again. This is Kelly Pope. And
Professor Fraud, Bill Cressy from Governor State University.
And this is True Crime. And we were talking about, the reason why we were listening to Shaggy,
right,
is we were talking about a scam that is using his name. And so we may, hopefully we'll hear from him. We reached out to him via Twitter.
Yeah.
And so Shaggy, if you're listening, feel free to call or text into our conversation about you that we had on the last segment, 312-981-7200.
But then right before we went to break, we were talking about the idea that we know, as you call them,
red collar crimes,
where there is a murder involved, a death involved, to perpetrate a scam.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a report. This is from the New York Post, and working with a report from ProPublica. Oh, is it Publica? Whatever. I think that's the Latin pronunciation. But this, both of us have served on boards of hospitals, and we know that, you know, hospitals report various statistics. And in this case, this is a hospital in New Jersey that calls itself the Premier Heart Transplant Center. And one of the big statistics for heart transplants is 1 year survival rate.
Sure.
Did the patient live 1 year since the transplant?
Yes.
And
everybody has a metric, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well,
and everybody can cook the books with their metrics.
There you go. Exactly. And that's what they were doing. They inflated survival rates to keep its funding as the premier heart transplant center, allegedly.
But listen to this article, guys. Yeah. This is just wicked.
In at least one instance, and they feel there are several others, they kept a brain-dead patient on life support until he hit the one-year survival benchmark and then pulled the plug on him.
I told you it was wicked.
Yeah.
So, I mean, just think about what you just said, Bill.
Yeah.
We are so interested in cooking our books, cooking our financial records, that we keep a person that is brain-dead alive so we can cook our books and increase the metric
exactly,
to look more successful.
Family, again, quoting the article from New York Post, family members were never told that the patient was in an irreversible vegetative state after his heart transplant last year. Staff never offered hospice care, never offered other palliative care services, or do not resuscitate directive. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, doctors were secretly recorded discussing how they needed to aggressively care for the patient despite their belief that he would never wake up or recover functions. And they think a total of four instances were found where doctors manipulate survival stats that way and other ways.
But, you know, this makes me wonder. So compare and contrast this dupe scam that you just read to the Boeing situation.
Oh.
And where you had people on the ground, employees that knew, pilots that knew that things were wrong. People ended up dying because no one said anything. Now, in this case, this is a little different because you have a person that will never recover. Is it unethical to do what this hospital was doing?
Again, if they were keeping the information away from the family, if they, you know, were deliberately keeping the person alive. And again, this isn't the only instance. They reported on another case where doctors were recorded mentioning in passing that an unnamed female lung transplant patient, they said that their mission was to keep that lady alive because they were coming up upon the survival rate reporting deadline.
Wow. This is a fascinating dilemma. If you're listening to us, please feel free to join our conversation. Text or call us at 312-981-7200. Is it wrong for a hospital to want to keep a patient alive to meet a financial metric? That's what we're really talking about here.
Yeah.
Is that wrong?
I would say yes. I mean, we put all of our faith and trust in our doctors.
And this is a very vulnerable point that a family member is in.
Right. And you put that faith in them with the understanding that they're looking out for your best interest, not their best interests. So.
Right. But this is the complicated part here. If the person is going to pass away anyway, this is what their thought process is. If the person is going to pass away anyway, who are we harming?
The patient out there who's trying to decide which hospital they're going to go to based on the metric, based on that statistic. And maybe there is an honest hospital that's reporting a somewhat lower number than what this hospital is reporting. And so they go, well, this hospital is obviously the best. Well, they were cooking their books to get it. It's not unlike, in kind of another sense, what happened between AT&T and MCI some years back,
mm-hmm.
where MCI was reporting these great earnings in their financial statements. AT&T couldn't keep up.
Sure.
The AT&T board fired two different CEOs of AT&T because they couldn't do what MCI was doing. Turns out MCI was cheating.
But we always look at things differently when there's human life involved.
Oh, gosh, yes. Of course, I think we have to.
We have to.
At least we should.
I mean, you think about the incident, the Takeda. What we were talking about last week.
About airbags.
With the airbags. And so they changed the what they use in the airbags, and it ended up killing people.
And they were using a high explosive to detonate the airbags, and the explosive itself was killing people.
Right.
So. Yikes. Would that be considered a red collar crime, Kelly?
Yes, it would be considered red collar crime. Again, red collar crime is when a white collar crime results in murder.
Turns deadly.
And sometimes accountants kill. Did you know that? I'm not going to kill you.
Not an accountant.
Yeah, sometimes.
Even a certified public accountant?
Yeah, sometimes. Ooh, sometimes accountants kill lawyers. In red collar crime.
Okay,
cases.
Now you're getting me scared here. It's after midnight and all, and I, you know, have you been watching Dateline or something?
Always.
It's like, they seem to be such a good working couple. I always, my wife loves those shows, and it kind of gets me a little creepy sometimes. Yeah. But they are good programs. Interesting.
So,
stuff.
What was the name of the hospital again?
I didn't name it deliberately.
Okay. Yes. But it's in the article.
And anyone's interested, you can do a Google search on New York Post, and it was published on October 3rd. So look for that article. So, the lengths that people will do to perpetrate a scam.
Right.
Yeah.
All about the numbers, cooking the books.
Okay.
So we're going to go to news now.
Let's go to news.
Okay. So we are back. I am Kelly Pope.
And I'm Professor Fraud, Bill Cressy.
I think we're going to have you on Dancing with the Stars.
Dancing with the professors.
Yeah. If there's ever a local audition, I'll let you know.
There's a radio version of Dancing with the Stars. Yeah.
There is, in fact, Chicago Stars. We do that every year.
I know. And it raises great money for the American Cancer Society, right?
And you get to see Professor Fraud dance.
Yeah, well,
maybe.
I don't think he'd raise any money.
I think we need the radio version of Dancing with the Stars for that. But yeah, I asked for that. Specifically.
So you could annoy
Dancing
me?
Dancing Queen. Oh, of course.
Yeah. You look great. You look
great.
Well,
thank you.
So you have joined Bill and Kelly talking about the latest dupes of the week, and we love to do this in our last hour. Bill and I don't know. Are we going to bring back our podcast or what? We are Dupe of the Week podcast?
Well, right now, our program becomes a podcast because that guy behind that window there, Michael, the magnificent producer, puts all this up on the WGN website.
Quickly, by my dad.
Very quickly, because he never sleeps.
He doesn't sleep.
Yeah. So,
he's like Fraud. Fraud never sleeps, right? Is that what you say?
Exactly. Fraud never sleeps, and neither does Mike. And so he'll have that up. So anybody missed any of this, hey, you could tune in and listen to it, and you can hear Kelly's appraisal of my dancing abilities.
And they can also catch any other of your past shows, too, on WGN. WGNRadio.com if you just search True Crime or Kelly Pope or Bill Cressy.
There you go.
There we go.
Hey, you know what I was at yesterday, Kelly?
Where were you at?
The Bears game.
Oh, was it cold?
It was damp. The fog kind of settled in over Soldier Field.
Oh, no, wait, Bill.
Yes?
I think you were at Soldier. Weren't you at the museum?
No, I was at Soldier Field.
Where was that picture of you and Aaron?
We were in a place that's called the Midway at Soldier Field.
Okay.
And we were sitting in front of, because it was damp and cold out there, and the Bears, not doing so well. We were at the Midway, sitting in front of a fireplace, watching the game on big screen TVs.
It looked very comfortable and cozy.
It was very cozy and comfortable, and it's the only way to watch, you know, when the Bears are playing kind of like that. But, you know, some folks, when they go to a Bears game, mm-hmm. they like to have a nice cold one. And by cold one, I mean beer.
Okay.
And a 16-ounce Miller Lite, and I don't drink beer.
Okay.
I'm allergic to hops, but a 16-ounce Miller Lite, which some people say isn't all that great, it costs you $10.
Okay.
Or 10 and a quarter. And then a premium beer can cost you, you know, like $16.
So I'm sitting here waiting.
Okay. A lot of people think that's expensive.
Yes.
Well, not so much as if you're going to a Miami Dolphins game.
All right.
Okay. Where two beers cost this one gentleman $724.
No way. Shut the front door.
Yeah, it's already shut. This was reported in our friends there at the Miami Herald.
Okay.
When buying drinks at Miami sporting events, fans can generally expect to make a few financial concessions, chiefly eating the extra few dollars vendors tack onto food and drink purchases. Selling ordinarily cheap beer for a few dollars more may seem like a scam to some fans, but on Sunday afternoon, and this is a few weeks ago, a rogue beer vendor...
Rogue beer vendor.
Yes.
Never heard of such.
Okay.
A rogue beer vendor.
A 33-year-old walking vendor was busted at the Miami Dolphins game for charging a fan $724 for two beers.
No, come on. There's more to the story than this. Come on. You're not going to close this up.
No, I'm going to leave it at that. No. And as the Miami Herald reports, this was a game, Los Angeles Chargers versus the Miami Dolphins. And while the Chargers robbed the fans of any hope of a win, this beer vendor tried making off with hundreds of dollars from an unsuspecting fan. He grabbed the fan's credit card.
Okay.
And swiped it, because the vendors have credit card machines. But he had his own machine.
Yeah. Okay. You can easily get a Square. We can order that right now.
Right.
You can have one, too.
He swiped it using a personal card reader, not the device that the stadium provides to the vendors.
But he was a rogue vendor, so of course he didn't have that, right?
Well, he was rogue because this is what he was doing. He was a regular vendor.
Oh.
But rather than using the one the stadium gave him, he had his own. And he swiped this guy's credit card. Shortly after the transaction was processed, the fan received an alert from his bank.
Sure.
Good bank.
Good internal control bank.
Notifying him of a steep charge to his card.
We're looking at anomalies. Anything unusual, you get a message.
And where this beer vendor screwed up, he registered his machine under his own name.
He didn't take my class or your class. That was the problem.
It displayed the vendor's name. And he was not, he was working for, at the stadium, they actually have a third-party concession company handling it. He was working for the subcontractor, and according to a spokesman for the company, that's who he was working for.
Wait a minute.
And they recognized the guy and called the authorities, and before the game was over, he was arrested.
Yes. Why did the rogue vendor charge $700? Why? I mean, what if he had just charged $100 seven times to seven different people? He probably could have gotten away with it.
He probably would have gotten away with it, yes. But you'll be happy to know.
Why did he think
arrested, he was fired.
No, but think about that. Why would he think? Two mistakes here.
Yeah.
Why would he think that he could get away with a $700 charge?
Yeah,
why?
Because he's not too bright, you know. As you know, the sign says, sometimes it's because you're stupid and you make bad choices. Okay, but he thought he could do it under his own name. without getting caught.
You're out there, rogue vendor, give us a call because we'd like to talk to you too.
Yeah, I think this victim also made a number of mistakes, handing the credit card over to someone and not paying close enough attention, and of course, just going to Miami Dolphins game alone is
wait a minute, though. We can't blame the consumer, right? Because of course he paid for a beer. That's what everybody does.
That's right.
I don't go to a lot of football games. Hey, Mike, do you go to football games, Bears games, or any games?
Ever so often. Never have I spent $700 on a beer, though.
But you have given over your debit card, credit card, right, to the vendor to buy.
Without even thinking, yes.
Of course. There's nothing you can do to protect yourself from that one.
Well, walk up to the concession stand, buy it there, and put it in the machine.
Wait, Bill.
Or do what I do, which is, sneak it into the stadium.
But what if there's a big sign that says don't do that? You're not going
to
do
it. Well, you have to go through security and everything. So, so it's not easy at all. And as I say, I don't drink beer, so I just, drink soda pop and caffeinated pop so I can stay awake all night and talk on the radio. So, there you go.
Yes, I want to share with you guys something.
Go right ahead.
So, from our earlier conversations when we had Attorney McDowell on the phone, we just got a text about the pigeon drop. Somebody that feels like me, they're talking about the pigeon drop. I want to read this to you.
Yeah.
This person is saying the pigeon drop may be hard with someone you don't know, because that's sort of how we talked about it.
Right.
But imagine if you instead found a check, a young person approaches you outside of 7-Eleven, tells and shows you they have a winning scratch-off lottery ticket, but can't cash it because they are under 18. It's a $200 winner. I'll give it to you for $100 and you can cash it in. Real ticket, but it's already been redeemed and the barcode won't work twice. It's a good scam, too.
And it's really just a variation on the theme of the pigeon drop.
Well, but an important variation. Because the difference with what we were talking about on the show was the vulnerability of a stranger. We all have a heart when it's a child.
Yes.
A child comes up, I found this, but I'm not old enough. Can you help me? Bill, can you help me?
That's because you have children. I don't.
So you don't care.
Kick them to the curb. That's where I am. It's funny. I read a terrible, it's not really a scam. It was a stunt somebody did where they had someone they worked with who every week buys a lotto ticket and they put it in their drawer, the front desk drawer of their desk at work. And so what this crew did, they were like, let's do something funny. And so the morning after the lottery numbers were pulled, they bought a lotto ticket with the winning numbers from the last drawing. And so they snuck it in this guy's desk. Well, the morning comes, the guy opens up his desk and he takes out his lottery ticket, compares it to the numbers. He thought this was the one he bought. It was the one that was actually bought that morning, which had the winning numbers, but it's not good because it's this, after the drawing. He thought he had won $500 million. And ha ha, good joke, ha ha, we made you. Before they could tell him it was a joke, he went in and told off his boss.
No.
Yeah. So
that wasn't good.
Yeah, no, not
how
that.
Did you? How were you really feeling that day?
Yeah, so then they had to go and tell him, we bought that ticket this morning, stuck it in your desk. We were just trying to be funny. Ha ha ha.
So what else do you have over there on our Dupe of the Week segment?
Okay, now you were talking about you watch HGTV and all the house flippers and all
you
that kind of
too.
Stuff.
You do too. Don't even try it. You do too.
Yeah, I do. especially like that Brady Bunch show.
You said that a couple weeks back.
Yeah, there you go. Well, do you go to craft fairs and things like that? Are you crafty?
No.
I mean, in that sense,
my daughter likes crafts, but no, I'm not crafty.
Well, this is from Canada. And,
Canadians are honest.
Canadians are honest. I was so surprised to say, we should have on a friend of mine is the former head of fraud investigations for the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. He now has his own firm, but we should get him on the phone one night and talk about
frauds in Canada.
Canadian frauds. Yeah, there you go. Well, this was a woman who made up a craft show and is now arrested and charged with fraud.
Wait a minute.
Okay.
She made up a craft show?
Yeah.
Sort of like the Fry Festival?
Well, right. It's like, we're going to have a craft show, and if you
Fire want, Festival.
A Fire Festival, we're yes. Up. Yeah. The
of course.
Yeah, the Fire Festival was a rock concert on an island in the Caribbean.
All made up.
It was all
made
up.
Sort of made up, right?
Essentially, yeah, it was, the promises were much bigger than
it was
than
sort of made up, right? Up.
Yeah, sort of made up, yeah. Well, what they were promising, they were just out of thin air. Right. Well, this was a craft show that never existed.
And she sold tickets to it?
No, she got vendors. People who sell stuff at craft shows.
They paid her.
They paid her to show up at a craft show. Okay. Let's see. Apparently, just under $5,000 they paid her so they could have booths at the craft show
that
never existed.
Think she'll go to jail?
I don't know. Canadians are awful tough on people that aren't honest, you know? So they defrauded people by paying for a vendor space at a, and here's, of course, the hook, a made-up charity craft show.
Oh, come on.
They several vendors claimed that she sold booths for a fraudulent charity craft show, and
the charity?
Doesn't say. They were contacted by the Durham police, not Durham, North Carolina.
I was about to say, that's okay. Where I'm from.
I know, but you're from the other Durham, one in North Carolina,
okay.
Not the Durham up in Canada.
Okay. Don't talk about Durham, Bull City here.
They rented space for a craft show that was supposed to take place in Oshawa, Canada, and the proceeds were supposed to go donated to a local charity. And then on the day that the craft show was to take place, the victim showed up and realized, hey, there's no one here. There's nothing going on. So that's how they got to meet each other and said, let's go to the police together and report.
Those are some vigilant people, because I don't know. Maybe I would just be like, you know what? I lost this money. I'm not sure I'm going to do it. No, I wouldn't do that. I'd go to the police.
Yeah.
I would go.
lots of interesting stuff. And again, in the last segment, we were talking about the pigeon drop. And would you trust someone, a stranger, with your money?
Well, but this is the thing. We have to. I mean, if I was a vendor and I wanted to go to some type of festival, some type of showing, I'm going to pay a vendor fee. I don't know where it's going. So you have to. I mean, It's just what how we look at transactions. So there's no way around it.
Okay. Well, I'm going to give you another one. This is a cellular biology genetics undergraduate student at the University of Georgia.
Wait a minute. Before you get to that one.
Okay.
Get to the professor at Drexel.
Okay.
We have to tell Mike this because Mike doesn't know about this one. Let's share this one with Mike.
This is the real professor fraud here.
Yeah, this is the real professor fraud.
At Drexel University, okay, and this was reported in USA Today, college professors spent nearly $190,000 of federal grant money on strip clubs.
What?
That's a lot of $1 bills.
Hey,
you know that?
Yeah.
Hey.
Wait, this is a governor state?
No, I'm just saying. Never. Just because we're named after the governors of the state of Illinois, 40% of whom in recent years have gone to federal prison. No, this was Drexel University.
But let me tell you guys what the best one, when I saw this posted on LinkedIn,
yeah.
The funniest thing about this were all the comments people were making. Like, wonder what he was studying. It was just so funny.
The comment section is always the best.
Always the best.
And LinkedIn. It's just on usually LinkedIn, very, very staid.
People couldn't help it. Yeah. I don't know if I can read some of them. So
don't. We don't want to get in trouble with the FCC. Okay. A former university professor in Philadelphia, Drexel University, spent tens of thousands of dollars in federal money on local strip clubs and sports bars as well.
So he's rounded out.
Yeah, he's multiple interests. According to the Justice Department, the professor misused actually $189,062 of government grants.
And he's going to go to jail.
Most probably, yeah.
Most probably. Is that your legal response?
That's, as I tell my business law students, the answer to most legal questions is, it depends.
You know, I had a question. When you're doing this kind of stuff, is he using, like, the company credit card, like, at the strip club with the
school logo on it?
School logo. Like, how does this happen where he's equating these kind of funds to something so nefarious, like when he's not, is he not thinking? Is he?
I'm guessing he just submitted the receipts.
Oh, please. No.
He expensed it on his like monthly report.
Exactly.
He had to have issued some phony invoices. He had to have.
Because
he couldn't have. But you know what, though, Mike? Maybe he did present the credit card that had Drexel University, because why would they care?
True. But you think that like after like the fourth month of like horse feathers like coming up on
I will tell you the grants that he had applied for, federal grants from the U.S. Navy. Ugh. It was actually NCIS that came up with this. Now, the real one. Okay.
Not the TV show.
The grants were to be spent on research related to energy and naval technology.
That's what.
But revealed that he used the money for personal iTunes purchases and for, quote, goods and services, end quote, provided by cheerleaders, Club Risque, and the Tacony Club. So you would think if you're submitting an expense report and Club Risque shows up on
it,
you would, and what my favorite quote is, Drexel University made in a statement that he was placed on administrative leave during the investigation and that it's improving its auditing controls.
Well, clearly. But listen, Bill, we have to figure out. We need to figure out what he submitted.
Because we can do it?
No.
Oh, no.
But I think Mike asked a really good question. Like, how did he get away with this? How did he get away with it? How was it discovered? We've just talked about this. How did he get away with this? What was he submitting?
And actually, he got away with it for 10 years.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
10 years?
Well, you know, $200,000 or $190,000 at strip clubs. I mean, it only comes to that $19,000 a year.
If there's anybody out there from Drexel University listening, Bill and I will come up there and we'll do a couple fraud workshops with you. Us know. Call in 312-981-7200.
There you go.
Wow.
Or you can text that same number.
Yes. Wow.
Okay. Can I do the one for the University of Georgia? Let's go back down south.
All right. Pick on the Southerners.
Okay. There you go. Okay. Now, here's a 22-year-old undergrad biology student. He convinced 117 people that he was, in fact, a business school student with a risk-free hedge fund. Okay. First of all, right there, you know it's a problem. Risk-free hedge fund. Okay. And boasted about investments from famous NFL players as well. And it was a Ponzi scheme. And he scammed them all out of $1 million, which he spent on, guess what?
Strip clubs.
Strip clubs, yes.
There's a common theme here.
That's $1 million strip club fraud here by an undergraduate student. 22.
And his life is ruined.
I almost hope so.
Yes, his life is ruined.
Yeah, he pled guilty and he's awaiting sentencing.
So let's take a break here, and we'll be back with a few more dupes of the weeks after break.